All right, welcome back. So before I start, there's a question about what is mindfulness? What's the general definition of mindfulness? And mindfulness, there's a wide range of how it's defined, but one person, I think Jon Kabat-Zinn, talked about it basically being paying attention on purpose. It's like the attentional, resting our attention on something. So there's that steadiness of attention, and there's also the quality of being non-judgmental with what we're paying attention to. Because we can be like the cat at the mouse hole, really focused, but there's this anticipation, there's this agenda that the cat holds over the mouse. And so it's this paying attention on purpose, paying attention with the steadiness of attention, without judgment, without agenda. Now, another way we can define mindfulness, and this is where my teacher often would do it, and I think it can be helpful. And that's a sense of who mindfulness is when we are choosing to rest our attention on something. It could be on one thing like our breath, our body. It could be on a wide range. I'm just sitting in the middle of my experience. This is all forms of mindfulness. While he would often talk about awareness is more this choiceless quality. When we start to, the sense of me starts to soften and dissolve. So awareness itself is what's looking, what's perceiving. So hopefully that's helpful. So now I'd like to talk tonight about what's called the five precepts. Okay, so this is going more into the Buddhist teachings, but also at the same time, it's just how to be a good human being and starting to see how this interface between what we're learning in our practice relates to how we show up in the world, how we act in the world. Because meditation is not just about having these profound insights, these profound experiences, or even just a pleasant experience, or learning how to turn down our stress, our anxiety. These are all very helpful things of meditation. But meditation is also designed to teach us how to be in the world, how to be in our relationships, to be how we act in our work, how we act in society as a whole. Because it's really a profound teaching of how to have this steady attention. It's really related to, what is mindfulness? What's awareness? The steady attention and friendly attention. And that allows us to see very clearly through our distortions, through our prejudice, our biases, to actually see life, see another person, and to see ourselves in a much more clear, accurate light. And so now we start to take that into looking toward ourselves, to these deep, different patterns, even patterns of what creates our suffering, what releases our suffering. And these precepts, also we could think of them as ethical trainings, are a way of creating this container of exploration. Right. So I'd like to invite us to look at those in this way, not as a sense of some authority figure saying you need to do this because this is what this bigger authority says you should do, but much more an invitation to notice how we are at these edges, to see for ourselves. So that's one thing I really appreciate about this practice is that you're rarely told to do this or that, but more to look, to see for yourself. To see what the effects are on your mind and your body. And the more you attune to that, that gives you this whole level of information that you don't have when we just hold ourselves in sense of righteous opinion. So start to see them as not a morality that's being forced on us, as that may be other experiences we've had in our life, but see areas to explore for ourselves. For example, to see, when I tell a deliberate lie, what does it actually feel like internally? What's the kind of discord that feels, the sense of pressure, that sense of tension? So this is where we start to become our own authority. And that sensitivity grows, and now we turn that toward ourselves. One famous teacher who has passed away now, Ruth Denison, once said that when you practice, you start to not be able to get away with anything. And what she meant is that we start losing the ability to lie to ourselves because we start to see ourselves and all our hidden motivations, our hidden agendas more and more clearly. So we can't trick ourselves and convince ourselves we can't get away with anything, at least with ourselves. Now, it's an interesting thing to notice that quality of stillness, that sense of centeredness, of groundedness, and how that relates to our actions. Okay, when we act in a way that's kind, that's based in non-harm, there's often a natural stillness that starts to come into our minds and into our bodies. We're not so anxious and worried about getting caught or justifying or protecting or defending. We're able to just settle. Conversely, like when we are doing something that's, you know, harmful, that's breaking the law or you know, bending the law, there's a sense of discard that comes into us. When we do something that's hurtful to another person, it reflects in our bodies. And stillness, that quietude, becomes less accessible. You can almost see that as we break these precepts, there's a noise that comes up, emotional, physical. Because our minds really lead our actions. You know, any action we do, our mind is kind of the forerunner of that. And our actions sometimes reveal what our mind is really thinking, what we're really, our deeper motivation. It leads our tendencies. So that's why this gift of the pause is so helpful, to slow down and let that be seen, like as Peter was talking about with the impulse to open the newspaper and having set an intention to take a break from reading it. You can feel by pausing, you can feel all that urgency to read come up. This happens in so many different ways in our life. You know, the urge to send that angry email, to lash out, to honk your horn, however it might show up. Pause and feel what that is like in the body. Because often those actions, they're really led by the unconscious, by our unconscious impulses. You know, if we're not aware of our thoughts, especially those deeper belief structures, it leads to actions of speech, of mind and body, which cause harm in the world. So meditation, mindfulness, allows us to start to slow down the process. There's actually a chance to pause, to unhook ourselves from our immediate action. As we do this, as we start to become more attuned to kind of the unconscious intentions and motivations of our minds and our bodies, our words, it's really important not to become afraid of what our minds are saying, to become afraid. It's important not to become afraid of our thoughts, of what arises through our minds. Because if we overlay judgment on that, you know, the morality, a sense of induced immorality of what I should or shouldn't be doing, it creates a level of tension, of inner tension, and actually creates a level of shadow. It starts to create this pressure cooker that starts to build up more and more until it pops its lid. And that's where sometimes spirituality and religious training can go wrong, when we deny what's here. Because I'm a spiritual person, because I'm a religious person, I can't have those thoughts. That doesn't fit into my self-image. Right? So learning to see, to have that basic friendliness of whatever comes through my mind, I can observe it. It's just because a thought arises, we know we don't have to act from it. And that's the saving grace. But if we deny the fact that thoughts are arising, it's much more likely to go underground and come out sideways. So this key aspect of being able to look deeply, but also how we look with a non-agenda, with an honest seeing. Because otherwise, aspects of ourselves become hidden. So we can't have that sense, I'm going to see everything, and then once I see it, I'm going to judge it. That's just going to close down aspects of ourselves. So we start to become like our own cherished confidant, that you can say or feel anything to show it all. That all aspects of yourself can be seen by you without fear or judgment. And this allows us to start to understand those things. Again, the action from those, that pause allows us to create that space. Sometimes we think if we allow ourselves to see something, we're going to act from it. I think very contrary. The more you see it, the more you admit that shadow that we all have, the much less likely you are to act from it. Yeah, because we can't change how the emotions are arising, the thoughts. But we can work with is how we act from them, how we relate to them. That's really where our responsibility comes in. So let's go into these five precepts. So I'm going to offer some of the classic phrasing just so you can recognize them. But treat them as an ally, as a kind of a container or a sense of when you bump up against one of them, not to judge yourself, but to say, oh, this is interesting. I'm really feeling this urge to steal something, to lie, to lash out in a certain way, to become curious. Oh, what is going on here? All held by this quality of pausing and the power of meditation to actually look and see what's present. So we start to see earlier and earlier this inclination toward harm. And it's much easier to see the very beginning of that than after we've already thrown the brick and we have to clean up the mess. It's much easier to see at an early stage. So these five precepts are often phrased as refraining from or undertaking the training to refrain from. Isn't that interesting? It's different than shalt not. To undertake the training to refrain from. Okay, from killing or harming living beings. This is the first one. So if you recall back to the talk on the hindrances, that quality of aversion, of not wanting, the movement away. So harming and killing is part of that same spectrum. It's the same kind of energy toward it. It's going to have the quality of anger, that maybe we become feel hurt. We feel like we've been, boundaries have been crossed, dismissed. And so the trick is to feel those, to recognize those, and then choose, okay, what's the appropriate response? So it's not about not having boundaries. It's about having clarity around it, connecting with the core of what's been triggered and hurt, but not meaning that we have to be a doormat. There's a story that Sharon Salzberg, someone I mentioned before, one of the early Western pioneers in this tradition, was studying in Asia, and she was, you know, taking a, what do you call it, a rickshaw through the part of town, and this drunk tried to pull her off and insult and wanted to assault her. And she was managed to kind of beat this person off and got back to her teacher and shared that experience. And her teacher said, well, Sharon, you should have, with all the love in your heart, took your umbrella and hit him over the head. And this is such a great phrasing of how to have that sense of interconnection and yet clear boundaries. So non-harm, you know, means that we may still have to push back and have that those lines of boundaries to protect ourselves, to get away. This one of these things that come up around this precept is how we take certain categories of being, like insects or, you know, annoying things that we just think they don't deserve to live. They're just pests. Sometimes if we look deeply, we see that categories of beings, of other human beings that we hold as less than. And so it justifies our ill treatment, our harm toward them. And you can play with this. Like next time we have mosquito season, when a mosquito lands on you, pausing and saying, okay, do you have another option than ending this mosquito's life? Can I take this precept of non-harm? Now, refraining from, you know, I like to tell this kind of humorous story about my own experience in working with this precept, that when my daughter was a toddler, we had some yellow jacket nest in our backyard, and I was worried about her getting stung and her little friends getting stung, so I wanted to remove the nest, but I also wanted to honor this precept of non-harm. And so being a little foolhardy naive, I thought, okay, I'll knock down the nest and run away. So I did that, and I didn't get stung. But those yellow jackets really liked that spot, so they built the nest back, you know, full size. And so the next thing I thought was, okay, I'm going to take that nest and I'm going to relocate it. I don't know what I was thinking, but I got a garbage can and put it underneath the nest and knocked it down and it fell in the garbage can and I covered it up again without being stung. And I took it to a remote part of a local park and released it, ran away again, not being stung. So I thought, okay, I'm being a good Buddhist. I'm practicing non-harm. And yet those yellow jackets somehow found their way back and built the nest again. So finally I took out the can of Raid and I sprayed the nest. But by really pausing to practicing this precept, there's a very different relationship to how I felt inside as I killed those creatures. It really was a sense of heaviness, of remorse and regret. And also that this is the only solution that I saw at the time. And so working with the precepts in this way to understand that there are times that, you know, we do have to kill something like a rat that's gone into our basement or something, a termite's eating our house, but to do it not with this dismissing of this living creature, but to really acknowledge what you're doing. So this is the precept to refrain from killing, from harming. The next precept is to refrain from taking that which is not freely given, or we can say shorthand, to refrain from stealing. And again, looking at the hindrances, stealing is so often driven by craving, you know, driven by that sense of lack, that I want this, the movement towards something. And sometimes it can be so intense it drives our action. Sometimes it can be, you know, really, it's interesting to notice if you do that pausing, that slowing down, and notice what's going on in the mind. I remember a long time ago, I was working for an agency, and I just had this, I wanted to take some supplies, you know, for my own use. And I just kind of justified in my mind how I do this, all this extra work I don't get paid for and they're not going to miss it. All this rationalization. I hadn't started practicing at that point. But looking back to it, I could remember how the mind was really active in justifying. And while we choose to act in a way that's not space and stealing, there's a settledness. There's a quiet that starts to come over us. So you start to notice that inner stillness or noise, you know, because we can justify anything. But if we start to value the stillness over the content of our mind, we start to see the mind just as thoughts that come and go. We start to know, have a clearer choice. So playing with this with, you know, even simple ways, easy ways, you know, this is with COVID, it's not quite a good example, but like at Costco, when you have or any grocery stores, the samples laid out and, you know, how many of us have kind of gone by a few times to get that really choice bit of chocolate that's been offered? You know, is that really what's intended by those samples? So they're kind of playing with those edges and seeing, okay, what's really been freely offered? You know, what's been offered without any strings attached, and then accepting that, you know, and starting to work with these patterns of lack and of craving. The next precept, the third precept, is refrain from sexual misconduct. Refrain from harming through our sexuality. So again, looking at the hindrances, this is often driven by the hindrance of craving. You know, that wanting, that desire, that lust. Sometimes it's driven by the movement away from the pain of reality, you know, that we want to escape the difficultness that we're having. Remember this art, this commercial or this ad I saw for a divorce lawyer. And the divorce lawyer, she just had this picture of a male and female, not their face, just their torso. And of course, they're, you know, very attractive people. And the caption was, "Life is too short." Right? So she was really highlighting this sense of longing, this sense of inadequacy and that fulfillment, that promise happens, you know, and going through divorce through that. So connecting with that underlying pain that may be motivating our sexual activity is one way of working with this. Of course, there's the overt ways, you know, of how we harm people much more overtly and destructively through assault, through molestation, you know, and perhaps we have experienced that ourselves. We know how deeply the harm is. Even more subtly, noticing how we just objectify the members of whatever sexual orientation we find attractive. We see them as sexual beings instead of who they actually are as people. So you can see how that overlays that. And this precept isn't about how, not denying the fact that we're sexual beings. It's not about defining how we should be sexual or how that even should arise, but just connecting that with our heart, connecting that with our wisdom, with our discernment. You know, is this really a consensual interaction? Is there any power dynamics that can cause things not to be balanced, not to be easy, not to be safe for each person? To see the whole person with when we're sexual, with ourselves or with other beings. So we start to bring the harm that's so caused by sexuality and start to release that more and more. Now the fourth precept is to refrain from false speech. Okay, so this is a very powerful one. If you can imagine if the whole world took any of these precepts on and how radically we would be changed. How much life would be so much easier for everyone. So why do we lie? And why do we tell a lie? Is it coming from aversion? Is it coming from craving? You know, sometimes we tell a lie to cover something that we don't want to be seen. We want to hide this aspect. And so to learn to see clearly, this is the truth. This practice is so much about seeing what's actually here. And we start to deny that. We feel the dissonance. And you can notice next time you tell a lie, a big lie or a small lie, notice how the body is reacting to that. Noticing the quality of tension, the quality of tightness. And conversely, notice that when you speak the truth, there's a sense of settling, even if it may be a difficult thing to admit to share. Now, the classic teachings around truth, telling what's true, is also balanced with noticing if whether it's beneficial to this other person and also the right timing of sharing something. It's also balancing that. And not just saying that what your idea of is true, but actually realizing that your truth may be relative and also reflecting, is this really beneficial to this person? Is it beneficial to me? And is the timing right? And a good shorthand for this one is to simply speak from a kind heart, to touch into your heart before we speak. And the final precept is that of refraining from substances that cloud the mind, from intoxication, from getting drunk, getting impaired in some way. Now this precept is an interesting one because sometimes we may indulge in things. We may drink. We may have some substances that we enjoy and appreciate. And really the point is, where does it lead to heedlessness? You know, where does it lead to us to lose that sense of what's really helpful or not helpful, what's harmful or not harmful? Because we can become intoxicated to the point when we lose that contact. And then all these precepts, we are much more susceptible to breaking. So in this particular tradition, we don't say, we don't have this pronouncement that you're not supposed to drink or do any substances, but more bringing your attention to the heedlessness quality. You know, where is that separation from reality that those substances lead to? So these five precepts, treating them as trainings, as way things to explore, and starting to look at them not as an external authority telling you, but something that's an invitation to notice for yourself as I come up against those. How does it affect the mind and body, both when I break those precepts and push against them, and also when I follow those, and how there's a sense of growing safety and ease in yourself and in all your relationships. All right, let's just sit quietly for a few moments, letting those words settle.